Well, hello there, and welcome to the AFA podcast, the official podcast of animationforadults.com. In the latest interview episode, I got to speak with Maciej Grzybowski and Chris Levis, the directors of the brilliant new stop-motion short, The Girl Who Cried Pearls. So, without any further ado, here we go! So, welcome to the AFA podcast, and let's start off with, how did you get started off in animation?
How did we get started in animation? Well, it was, I guess, late 90s. We began sharing a studio. We're old friends from school, and we were both making working in the field of illustration. We would make magazine covers and pictures for book covers, things like that. And I guess we somehow quite naturally moved from drawing and painting things to making an image more photographically. We started whatever we would normally have painted, we started sculpting and lighting and taking photos of, because it just seemed, I don't know, seemed more adventurous to us. With time, you know, we got more and more elaborate, started building larger and larger sets and with more and more characters and more specific lighting. And friends of ours who would pass by the studio suggested that, you know, that we could, instead of trashing the entire thing after it was done, maybe move things along a little bit, maybe use our little, you know, wire armatures that we put into the puppets to articulate and to eventually make a moving picture.
Yeah, and actually my wife's cousin had an 8mm camera. My wife's cousin, Eric, from Sudbury, Ontario. So yeah. We invited him down for a couple days just to play around with the props we'd already built. And then we got that 8mm developed, just like, I don't know, like teenagers discovering their first movies. You know, we were so excited to see our little puppets move. We've never really stopped since.
Yeah, it was a thrill.
Why was it stop motion in particular that attracted you as opposed to any other any other form of animation?
Well, I think because we were doing art direction, and we were building a comic. We had a comic book every month in the late and not very missed Vice magazine, and that comic used props and sets and characters that we built, and we would just photograph them. So we were already, and any kind of little commercial gigs we did, where it was all kind of handcrafted, built sets and characters. So it really seemed, and it's very, it's a natural medium for collaboration as well. You know, passing back characters and clothes, much, much more so than passing a drawing back and forth between someone.
So how did The Girl Who Cried Pearls come about?
Oh, I think, we tend, for over the years, our method is, especially, you know, let's say when you're in a production, and at the time we were in the production of Madame Tootley Pootley, we would go out for beers at the end of the day. And because the production itself takes years, often we'll write the years it takes to animate, we'll go for beers and just start thinking up and playing around with stories. And I think we probably came up with dozens in that era. You know, it was quite a fertile period for us. And some of them took and some of them didn't. And some of them kind of stuck like a pebble in our shoe, and we kept working on them. And Girl Who Cried Pearls was one of them. So it goes way back.
Sometimes there's a seed of an idea without actually it having a kind of a body. And sometimes you just let it lie there on your shelf until something lies down next to it and becomes complementary. And, you know, sometimes when you have eight ideas stuck on top of each other, the story starts building itself.
Yeah. In our spare time, we built a puppet of this poor girl. It's not the one that's in the film, but we built a puppet of this girl with her little broom and a pearl. And it actually was on our shelf for a decade, waiting for a story to be told.
Yeah.
Awesome. I Here you've got quite an unconventional production method. How do you work with actors to?
Well, I mean, before we started working in film, we worked a lot in theater. That's my degree is actually in theater design, and so we're from that world of I guess our understanding of what a director is somebody who works with actors originally, and we love working with actors. It's really compared to animation, which is quite a pedantic medium, where you don't really once you start a shot, you don't really get to improvise very much. It has to be it's extremely rigorous. Whereas the idea of playing with actors is actually where you get to have the fun. It's where you get to try different angles, try different ideas, let the actors contribute their own thoughts to the process. And what we like to do is just kind of maybe sometimes sit back and observe and pick out the gestures which we find most compelling, and the actors' own contributions often lead us in interesting directions.
Yeah, so we actually make the entire film with actors in live action. And I think, in terms of, I guess, the regular teaching of animation, where storyboards are king, it's sort of an unconventional method. But, I think Gore Verbinski used a very similar method in the film Rango. Other directors have used similar ideas. So I think, Spike Jonze, when he was making Where the Wild Things Are, had his actors work that way. Wes Anderson works in a very similar way. I think it tends to be the kind of directors who love what an actor brings to a part, and that's absolutely can be done in animation.
What part of the problem is that if you don't do that, then the animator becomes not just the animator, but also a director and also the main actor. Because when you're working a puppet, you tend to self-reference. You might even look at yourself in the mirror and see how a gesture would work before you like while you're working on it. So I guess the danger there is that everyone in your film is an avatar of you. Whereas for us, it's always been more interesting to have other people bring in their own personalities and their own little complexities and actually pay attention to those little nuances that make that person unique. So if there's two people, for example, who are interacting with each other in a scene, they're not the same person. One could be a kid who's, like for example, like in the Pearls film, there's scenes between a pawnbroker and a child, and the child is very, it's they're very different actors. One is very nervous and jittery, as they should be for the role, and one is very economical and professional, very suave. And those characteristics are something that we can kind of steal from the performer and imbue into the puppet so that they actually have a kind of unique personality, which is a fun thing to do.
It shows in the animation the different style. How did you develop the film's visual style?
Oh, I think we started with a great deal of research into kind of Montreal of that period. For the puppets themselves, we were interested in trying some new materials. Tuli Puli and our films up till then had been we've been dealing with silicone puppets, and there becomes a kind of style of painterly style of silicone that you can see through a lot of stop motion, and we weren't interested in that for this for most of the characters. So we kind of thought we wanted to take the puppets back to a kind of let's say I almost like medieval marionettes or church sculptures and idols, and get that feeling of texture and age, and that also fit, insofar as it fit the story, that seemed like a really interesting way to go.
And it also all goes back to what I was talking about earlier with us being painters, I guess, originally, which is that those puppets, the way they're painted, that's exactly how we would have painted them if they were just 2D.
There's a different look between the puppets in
Yeah.
the sort the wraparound doll and the flashback, for want of a better word. What's the thinking behind the two different looks?
Well, it was exactly that, I think. So for the modern puppets, they actually were silicone, And because we wanted them to be quite complex and modern looking, we didn't paint them. We got a colleague of ours named Jean Labordette, who's an amazing painter, did all the complex wrinkles and textures and multi-layered painting on the old man and his granddaughter. Because we wanted a real contrast to the past, which was painted by us in our kind of style. And we wanted it to be much messier and more expressionistic, again, to kind of, I guess, to give an idea that this is a memory, that the memory itself is expressionistic and a little bit faded,
Yeah,
and
blurrier, more less detailed, and you've probably noticed that the puppets in the past, they don't their lips don't move, their eyes don't blink, and that was I mean, it was made out of this, we couldn't possibly it was also that we couldn't afford to do it, but our rationale behind that was that somebody turned us on to the idea that when you're recalling events from your past, let's say even childhood, you'll often remember where you were, who you were speaking with, what it was all about, and what the mood of the atmosphere was, but you don't ever remember people's lips moving. You don't remember their eyes blinking. It doesn't seem to matter. And so we thought that it was almost an experiment to see if that actually would work, whether going back into the past, we could do away with that, and whether it would still somehow be convincing.
yeah, I think, we wanted to prove to ourselves that we could get a quality of emotion and expression out of puppets without any tricks at all.
Also, in the last, what, 10, 15 years, we've both had kids, and we've ended up on many occasions entertaining them with dolls, whatever, a ping pong ball on a stick even. And you don't really need a lot of expressions. You just need to kind of, you need to give them a soul in the way that you're narrating them and moving them around, and the child will fill in the rest. They will completely recognize that little doll as being alive and having a spirit. And it still works. Puppets have a kind of magical power that way that works on you from childhood to for the rest of your life.
Sets and the backgrounds are incredible. Did
Thanks.
it did having a period setting, did that make it more challenging to craft everything?
No, I think,
Well,
I mean,
period.
I'd say the great challenge was the fact that we wrote the story with almost a feature film amount of set changes and scenery. There's so many exteriors. Our previously most ambitious film was Madame Tullypooly in terms of, and maybe Higgledy-Piggledy-Pop in terms, I guess maybe Higgledy had a similar amount of exteriors. Anyway, we don't, to a fault, we never write with the idea of how much budget it will be or whether this is too many scenes. And I'd say the great challenge here was, okay, now we're outside again, and now we have an establishing shot here, and now we have an establishing shot there, and what do these buildings look? And then at some point, I guess if we're starting in Paris, we have to establish Paris. And then we had to build this enormous Parisian house for a, 6 second opening shot.
But also, sure, there's research that goes into building these things. But for the most part, the story takes place in Montreal, which is where we live, and we love this city. We have almost a mythological understanding of it. We like the streets that we walk through every day are kind of haunted and magical for us. And so, there's sure that there's research, but at the same time, I think we were to a large degree building them as though we were making them out of memory, like that we were trying to build the mood that isn't necessarily the real one, but the one that how you would remember something, so a little, so not necessarily accurate historically, just more accurate in terms of the emotion.
What were the particular challenges you faced on this film?
I think, I mean, there were the two greatest
Well,
challenges
narration really, yeah.
came at the, I would say, actually, let's say three great challenges. One was the script, which we adjusted quite a bit at the end. The story didn't change, but the actual dialogue changed quite a bit when we had the classic problem that every filmmaker has, which is you put together, you plan your movie as best you can, then you shoot it. In our case, shooting takes years. Then you have your first assembly, and the film is a piece of garbage. It happens to everybody and it happened to us. And I think there's that dark night of the soul where you think you made a lousy film and there's no saving it. And for us, those challenges were the mouth animation that we had in The Old Man, the music, the edit, the script. I mean, it was a kind of,
Well, with that came kind of with the music and the script came a kind of very unique problem or challenge that we really never had to deal with, which is that this time we made two versions of a film. We made an English one and a French one, originally French. But our actors for those two different versions were different people, and they had a very Each one had a very specific voice. In the French version, it was an amazing local actor here in Montreal named James Hindman, who has a very deep, very romantic voice. And in the English version, we worked with Colin Fiore, a great Canadian Shakespearean actor, whose voice is very different, very a little thinner, but at the same time, very kind of calligraphic. Everything has a curl to it. We realized that the voice in each version became the kind of lead instrument musically almost, and our soundtrack, our musician composer for this film, Patrick Watson, had a kind of we gave him a very specific challenge, which is that he had to build a score which would work with both of these instruments, and in each case it kind of gave the film both versions are different. They have the timbre of the voice, the just by the fact that it's a different it created a different instrumentation. He had to find a way to complement those instruments individually without bulldozing over them, and at the same time supporting it, which was a something we've never really had to deal with. But it created something quite rich, I think.
Film has a feel of a European folk tale, but does it come from any existing tales at all, or is it completely original?
It's completely original. I mean, there's hints of old tales, but of course, it's inspired by a kind of Hans Christian Andersen sort of tale. There's elements of mythology of the moment that there's that anecdote of Eve crying pearls that we lift with sort of the myth within the myth. But no, it's a completely original story. We absolutely wrote it with the intention of making you feel like it's been around for a long time, that it's been told and retold, and this might be the latest telling. But I think once you start playing in those waters of fables, it's almost like the audience chooses to believe it's an old tale.
What do you want people to take away from The Girl Who Cried Pearls? Messages or moods or
Well, we definitely don't have any messages in anything we've ever made, and we are allergic to to any message. I think that comes from once we got to work with the writer and children's illustrator Maurice Sendak.
Oh, wow.
We adapted his work, Higgledy Piggledy Pop, and before we adapted his work, he said, "Whatever you do, like for God's sakes, don't teach them anything." And it's become, I mean, we haven't made a bumper sticker of that or t-shirts
That's the
or a
law.
sign, but it's a law of our company since he said that. The story is all. And there's something that we've learned and have grown to appreciate, which is you make your story and then it's not yours anymore. You pass it along and it's up to everyone who watches it to fill in the rest.
And we try to intentionally make it a little ambiguous, always, to always leave a little. You don't want to shovel meaning into the audience's head. It's disrespectful. It's much more fun to let somebody to leave somebody in a situation where they could argue about it with their friends for a night and have to rewatch it even. We welcome other people's interpretations of our work. There's never been, we've heard many of them from people who have seen our stuff, and no one has ever been wrong. Even if they understood it in a way that we never intended, they were still somehow correct, which means that it was in there. And you can after us at some point you become what we call a unreliable narrator. You can't trust yourself. You're not necessarily best suited to understand your own work.
Actually, the more you talk about it, I think the less you understand it. The more we do interviews and talk about the origins of it, the more we, I think we get into a kind of record groove of a myth, and forget even our own intentions, or it's people tell us their interpretations and that leaks into our interpretation. But I think what we can say, categorically is that this is exactly to the frame, the movie we wanted to make. This is, it had its own, it spoke to us. It had its own rules. The puppets had their own rules. The story had its own rules. We respected them as much as we possibly could to the best of our talent. And that's the movie, And I think that's something we're very proud of. And that's something we can kind of hold our head up no matter how the movie does or what anyone thinks of it, knowing that at least that's how we made it.
And it's a pleasure when somebody makes it their own. It's like I don't know if you experience that, but it sometimes happens with a song. Like you can sometimes hear a song by someone that feels so close to you that you can convince yourself that it was written for you, that it's about you. And that's okay. I think that's kind of amazing. Of course you're wrong, and of course it's a little conceited, but it's also you can tip your hat to the creator of that, who have made something so sublimely open-ended and sentimental that you can exist within it in your own right.
This one is a bit of a tough question, but have you given any thought to what you're working on next?
It is a tough question, and I think the chances are pretty good that it will involve puppets. I'd say
Yes.
that. We have at this point dedicated the best part of our lives to cinematic puppetry and to pushing that into new realms, and not even necessarily in the world of film. So I think without giving anything away, I think it might be as much a surprise to us as to you.
Often what happens is that somebody suggests something that instinctively seems to us like no way, that's not what we want to do. We have no interest in doing this kind of, for example, we spent some time working in the last decade on virtual reality projects, and it was one of those things where once that was put on the table, we rejected it immediately. And then walking home from the meeting, we were just like unsettled about it. Like, what? Why did we? Like, oh my God, do we have an ideology? Like, are we is do we have is the art company we started now have does it have rules? And that kind of I don't know, it made us feel terrible. It made us feel like we needed to write ourselves an essay as to why we're even artists in the first place. It certainly can't be so that we just do the one thing we know how to do and like and just do it over and over again. There's something often what we end up saying yes to and embracing fully is something that seems like the least likely thing we would ever want to do. And I think that's out of the reason we've been doing this for about 30 years is because of a system like that. It keeps us going into places where which actually it's nice to make something that surprises you. And that's kind of addictive.
Yeah, I think the challenge for us right now, of course, is that you start with our first film was Madame Tootley Pootley, and The Girl Who Cried Pearls is our latest film, and there's a kind of bookend quality to those films, and it means like let's say a certain era is ending, which means we have the freedom to start a new era, and that's both scary and exciting.
I look forward to finding out. Thanks so much for talking with us today. It's been a really fascinating conversation. And congratulations again on the film.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for watching it.
Thanks very much, man. We really appreciate it. That's the point of making these things.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to catch up with everything we're doing, visit us at animationforadults.com for the latest animation news, reviews, and stuff. On social media, you can find us on Twitter at AFA Blog. You can find us on Facebook, Pinterest, Tumblr, Instagram, and more coming soon. If you'd like to help us out, you can visit us at patreon.com/animationforadults, or make a donation via PayPal, or buy us a virtual coffee. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for more.